WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. And this is the sound of Borge Alslan trekking his way across the ice and snow-covered surface of Antarctica. On a good day, this is what Alslan heard on his Walkman. Last month, with the help of Jimi Hendrix, Borge Alslan became the first person to trek solo across the Antarctic continent, without the support of air supplies, sled dogs, or motorized transport. For 64 days, Alslan cross-country skied an average of 10 hours a day, facing temperatures which dropped to minus 63 degrees Fahrenheit, while dragging a 400-pound sled loaded with supplies. He follows in a long tradition of Norwegian polar explorers, most notably Roald Amundsen, the first person to reach the South Pole. Alslan is a deep sea diver by profession and lives with his wife and son in Oslo. In addition to his new Antarctic record, he's also the first person to complete solo unsupported treks to both the North and the South Pole. I asked him how the two ends of the Earth differ.
Well, the big difference is actually that the North Pole is an ocean surrounded by landmass, and the South Pole is a landmass surrounded by ocean. And when you walk to the North Pole, you're actually walking on a thin layer of ice, and it's constantly moving and breaking up, creating pressure ridges and open water. And the situations are much more different than from the South Pole, because the South Pole is a big glacier. It's 10,000 feet thick at the pole itself. And you're moving in a very monotone landscape, and while the challenges at the North Pole are maybe more instant and unpredictable, the challenges on the South Pole, it's like it's patience, it's just to keep going day after day, and maybe a more mental challenge, I would think.
I imagine Antarctica as an endless variation on white, on the color white. What does it look like?
It is, yeah, you're right. And but also the sky is blue and extremely beautiful. You have lots of variations in the sky. And I think it's the way you look at it, you have two choices. You can say that it's just white, cold, and horrible, and it will be that way. But you can also say it's beautiful. And if you look for variations in the sky, and if you look for things carved out in the snow by the wind, and I actually had a competition with myself that every day I had to find a nice piece of art in the snow, and when I did that, it was beautiful. And that's the kind of approach you really need to be able to go through that very lonely and cold landscape.
I imagine preparation must be crucial in a solo trek, no matter where you are. How long did you prepare for the trip across Antarctica?
2 years. I actually tried this expedition last year and I failed, so this was my second attempt, and preparation is probably the most crucial part, and I think that's what's divided me from the others who have tried that. I'm very thorough with the preparations and I have a lot of experience, and you have to do all the things yourself because you're the only one who knows how you want it, so it's a lot of work.
I read somewhere that you, maybe it wasn't for this trek, that you shaved down the bristles on your toothbrush to make it lighter because weight is so crucial.
I did actually do that on this trip, but that was to fit it in my pocket. It was not to save weight, but that's the kind of attitude you need, because you have to save every ounce and gram you can save. You really have to save. And so if you keep that attitude, you will in the end up with only the essential equipment, and you leave all the other stuff behind. And when you're starting off with 400 pounds, yeah, you can imagine that every kilo counts.
Did you have any last-minute additions, those kind of moments where you say, oh my God, how could I have forgotten that before you you took off?
I made one wrong choice, and that was my ski boots. I had two pairs of ski boots, and I took the wrong one. And the sole cracked on the ski boots. I was able to repair it, but that caused a lot of... the whole world was falling apart when I saw that crack underneath the ski boots. So I should have taken the other one, of course. Since I had the repair kit with me, I was able to lash it together with parachute cord, so it stayed good all the way. But apart from that, it wasn't anything I would have done differently.
For one of your expeditions, you drank a glass of pure olive oil for breakfast every day for a year to accustom your body to absorbing fat. What on earth gave you that idea?
That's part of the preparation, because my diet is opposite of everybody else's diet. In society now, you have to eat as little fat as possible, but on me, for my trek, I would burn maybe 7,000 calories a day, and because fat is higher in calories per gram, you need to take a lot of fat on the trip, but you also need to make your body accustomed to burning fat instead of carbohydrates. And also because it's better to have 10 kilos extra weight on your body instead of in the sledge as energy, I try to bulk up before I leave, and I also try to make my body adjusted to the high percentage of fat. So that's why I actually drank olive oil as a part of the preparation.
So did it work?
It did work, yeah. I gained 10 kilos and I lost 15.
Do you get an endorphin high every day as you exercise? The same way runners talk about an endorphin high?
No. No, I don't, because you're actually breaking down the body from day one. So you get more and more tired during the trek, and your muscle gets more and more stiff and more tired, and it's more and more difficult to get going in the morning. So I think it's probably the opposite.
Tell me what your daily routine was like.
The routine is very, very important, and I tend to stick to a very strict routine. So when the going is rough, I know that I have this routine to follow. I know that I have to go 10 hours a day, no matter what, and just surviving from hour to hour and just do the job. So the routine is merely waking up in the morning, having my porridge, breaking camp, and set off skiing for 1.5 hour, and then I have 10 minutes break. I take some food and drink, and I keep on going for 1.5 hour, and I do this procedure for 10 hours. Then I put up my small tent, secure it well, and put snow around it, so if the weather gets bad, it won't blow away. I go inside, I make my dinner, and that time I have my only relaxing time. I have a couple of hours in the evening where I can listen to some music, I can read. I had some books with me. And then it's 8 hours sleep, and I stick to those 8 hours because I need the energy. I need to be a little bit ahead of myself when I had to make decisions during the day. So that's a very, very important thing to keep the routine.
Well, what were your biggest obstacles? The weather?
No, not the weather. I think the weather was pretty bad this time. It was actually worse than last year, but... I have good clothing, I have good equipment, so I was prepared for that. I think crevasses is one of the biggest obstacles, and also the constant danger. You're always balancing on a fine line between success and failure, and you have to make a lot of evaluations, and you have to evaluate the risk, and you have to take... chances. It's impossible to go through and such an expedition without taking chances, and you just have to take the right chances.
Give me an example. Of a chance you took.
Crevasses, they are often covered by snow, and they can be crevassed fields which are very extensive, and you have to go through it, right through it, and you're coming to a snow bridge, which are the crevasses. There are like deep fissures in the ice. They can be 100 feet or more deep, and if you fall down, you will certainly die. And you want to go, but you want to reach your goal, so you have to go through the area, and you have a choice maybe of crossing a snow bridge, or you have the choice of walking 2 miles around the crevasse. And I tend to be on the safe side and thinking that it's better to arrive one day later than never to arrive.
Did you fall in any crevasses?
Not this time. Not this time. Last year I had an accident in a crevasse, but not this time.
What happened when you fell on that trip?
I was going from an island called Birkner Island, and I was going to cross from the island to the Ross Ice Shelf, which is a moving piece of ice. And just when in the edge of the island, I went through a crevasse, but I went through with one ski, and the other ski rested on the other bank, and also was supported by my dragging bars, which are connected me to the sledge. So I didn't go all the way down, but it was just like a trapdoor, and it happened so suddenly. The ski just went straight through, and I was lying there across this crevasse, and it was a pretty scary moment.
Borge Ausland is my guest. This January, he became the first person to cross Antarctica alone and unsupported. That means without the help of sled dogs or food drops or other outside assistance. We're going to take a short break now, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Norwegian adventurer Borge Ausland. He just became the first person to complete a solo, unsupported trek across Antarctica. You skied on cross-country skis and had the help of parasails attached to around your waist,
mm-hmm.
I imagine?
Yeah, it's like, if you can imagine, like a parachute. And I had two, one 12 square meter and one 24 square meter, so I could use it in different kinds of wind speed. And I attached it to my waist, and the sledge was obviously behind me, so I was kind of in the middle and trying to steer this thing. And it's actually not so easy as it sounds, because you have to keep balance, you have to keep direction, and you have to steer the parasail, and the wind is changing, and you have to be very careful not to sail in too strong winds, because you can damage yourself or get dragged away by the parasail and get knocked unconscious or something. So that was actually, among crevasses, that was actually one of the most dangerous things I did. But it was when the wind was good and stable, I had some very good progress with the parasail.
Well, give us an idea of what the sensation is like. Is it very bumpy because of the ice?
Yeah, it's can be very bumpy depending on the surface, but if I had the big parasail up and I had low winds and good surface, and I had Jimi Hendrix, the ultimate experience, on my Walkman, it was just a great sensation.
What else did you take that I guess you'd count among non-essentials, things that you took because they're essential to you in terms of staying sane?
Yeah, that was, I think, the tapes was very important. I had actually 30 tapes, so I should maybe cut some down to save weight on the tapes, but I tend to try to socialize and have a little bit extra on that side. So 30 tapes, lots of different rock and roll music. Well, you have Tom Petty, Into the Great Wide Open, and also Rolling Stones, Time Is on My Side, and some ZZ Top, good rock and roll, and yeah, I had good music.
You spent Christmas in your tent in the midst of a full snowstorm. How'd you celebrate?
I had a traditional Norwegian dinner, which is it's a lamb dinner, lamb meat, and dried and salted lamb meat. And then I also had something from home. I had some drawings from my son and letters from my parents and small things like that. And I actually had a very nice and quiet Christmas, and not having to stress around shopping for Christmas gifts as everybody else. So it was kind of good to be there. And the small things I got was just as valuable as any big and expensive gift which I might have got at home. So I liked it out there.
What did your son write and draw for you for your trip?
He actually drew my skis, and my skis were drawn with just small paintings of his own fantasy, dinosaurs, pirates, and you know what an 8-year-old can think of. So, and to have those skis and to look at the skis were a very important motivation factor for me during the trek, and also to be able to keep me on the safe side if I had to, as I spoke about, take any chances. I knew that I have to come home and I have to do this safely. So those skis were important in at least two different ways.
I think your coldest day came the day after Christmas. It was minus 63 degrees Fahrenheit. Maybe it's not possible to describe what that feels like. What does it do to your hair, to your eyelashes, and to your skin in that extreme temperature?
Yeah, it chills you straight through to your bone, and that was a very cold experience, obviously. And I had all my clothes on, still couldn't keep warm, and I actually didn't dare to stop. I knew that I just had to keep going to keep warm, and I skied for several hours until I was warm enough to put my tent up. So it was extremely cold, and I felt very, very small at that time and very vulnerable.
You had communicated with people. You were in contact via radio with your team, even though they didn't support you with food or other help. How did you navigate, or how did you together navigate?
I used most of the time when it was sun, I used my watch as a compass, and it's an old-fashioned method of keeping direction, and many people have forgotten how they do that, but I use my watch and I use the sun and then the shadow, which way the shadow points, because the sun at the local time, 12 o'clock in Antarctica, will point. The shadow will point directly due south, and it moves 15 degrees each hour. So by looking at the shadow my ski stick will make, I could just make the right angle with my ski, and then I would keep the right direction. So if it was sun up, I just use my watch and the sun, and taking my position at night in the tent. And with GPS. It's a GPS satellite navigator to take the position.
It's the global positioning satellite?
Yeah.
And if anything happened to you, your team knew where you were.
Yeah, I had. I try always to have three an independent safety system to be able to call help if the worst should happen. And one was the radio, and the other was a beacon who sent my position to the outside world via satellite, and so they could keep track of me all the time. That was on all the time. And the last thing was emergency beacon, which I always carried on my body.
I think you met with Sir Edmund Hillary. He's the first to scale Mount Everest, of course. And you went to the South Pole together on a little celebratory trip this January. What was that trip like? What did you all talk about?
Yeah, that trip was more or less like the icing of the cake for me. It was a victory trip to come back to the South Pole that way, just to spend the day and not having to ski for another 1,000 miles. So that was great, and especially being there with Sir Edmund Hillary, which is a man I admire a lot, and talking to him and feeling the same thoughts, sharing the thoughts, and having his response on my achievement, and also talking a little bit about his Everest achievements and all the similarities which are between us as adventurers, and that was a great moment.
What kind of war stories did you trade?
I think we talked about what I remember most is what that we talked about, the respect for nature, and that you don't go there to conquer nature. You want to work with the nature. And as he said, that I didn't conquer Everest. Everest let me do it. So I think that was what struck my mind now.
After you come back, how long does it take before you get itchy again to get out of civilization?
It takes a while. It's a hard journey. Lots of sacrifice, lots of struggle, it's constant danger, which is a great pressure. So it does take a while. And your next question will probably be what I will do next time, but I don't have any specific plans. All my energy has been gone to plan this expedition and go through with that, and I haven't really had the opportunity to look beyond that. So I will just go back to Norway now and settle down for a while, and then we'll see. I don't think I will do another major solo trip to the poles. I've been two times to the North Pole and two times to the South Pole, so I think I more or less have finished a chapter in my life when it comes to that. But maybe something totally different. We'll see.
Now you'll have to go somewhere hot.
Yeah, maybe a desert.
Borge Ausland, the first person to trek solo across Antarctica. This is Fresh Air.